Thank you for listening to the Crossroads Christian Church podcast. Crossroads is a multicultural gospel-centered church serving the Bay Ridge and Sunset Park neighborhoods of Brooklyn, New York. If you would like to learn more about our faith community, please visit crossroadsbrooklyn.com.
Amen. When I was a teenager, I was really into music, like most of us are at that age. And one of my favorite television shows at the time was VH1 Storytellers. Some of you may remember that one. And then there was another, MTV Unplugged on MTV, pretty similar. And on VH1 Storytellers, MTV Unplugged, what the television show was about was they would bring in artists, the most famous musical artists in at that time, and they would play all their hits. They'd play all the biggest songs. And I remember, but they would play their songs, but then they would tell the stories behind the songs. So they would say, this is why I wrote this song. This is what this song means to me. And I remember as a teenager watching one of my favorite artists of all time, Eric Clapton, sitting on a stage, and just before he played the song Tears in Heaven, he explained how that song came about. And he told the story of how that song was written about his 4-year-old son, Connor, who ran out of a window accidentally and fell 53 stories to his death from their 57th Street apartment in Manhattan. And that's the story, that this is a song about Eric Clapton's 4-year-old son who died tragically. And the song is already sobering enough, but when you know the story, then the lyrics begin to even have they pack a bigger punch. And so when you know the story, these lyrics can hit you in a very deep way when Eric Clapton says, time can bring you down. Time can bend your knees. Time can break your heart and have you begging, please. And then there's a line in the song where he says, beyond the door, there's peace, I'm sure. And I know there'll be no more tears in heaven. And you feel, when you know the story behind it, you can feel the angst in his words even more than you ever had before. And that even the guitar riff, that sobering acoustic guitar riff, if you know that song, has deeper meaning to you when you understand the depth of that story. You see, songs and stories complement one another. There's a story behind every song. And the stories complement the song, and the song gives insight into the story. And we have been studying the life of David for the last several weeks. And we've already seen that David was a warrior. He defeated a giant. We've seen that he's a king. God anointed him as king over all his brothers. But today we see that he was also a poet. David was also a songwriter. And often it's his songs. He wrote much of the Psalms that we read. His songs actually give us great insight into the type of man that he was beyond just the narratives we read about him in 1 and 2 Samuel. And today, the song that we're looking at is Psalm 57. And the story behind that is 1 Samuel 21 through 23. And in this song and in this story, we learn and we see a David who teaches us how to worship God in the midst of overwhelming circumstances. And so the story is 1 Samuel 21 through 23, which will set the context for the psalm that we're going to be studying today. And so I want to do something different and set the context today from David's perspective. So imagine we're watching VH1 Storytellers, and King David is the musical guest, and he's a little older now. He's at the end of his career, and he's looking back on his life. And so just imagine there's David, and he's sitting on a stool on a stage in the round with an old beat up Martin D45 in his lap. And he says to us before he plays this song, he says, before I play this next one, it's called Psalm 57, but before I play it for you, I want you to hear the story behind it. And of course he says, you know, you can actually read about the story behind this song in my biography. A guy named Samuel wrote it. It's called 1 Samuel. That's part one. The second part is called 2 Samuel. But in my biography, 1 Samuel, in chapter 21, you can read the story behind this song. And he says, you see, when I was just a teenager, I was a little runt. There was nothing spectacular about me, but I fought this giant named Goliath. this giant named Goliath came and he started tormenting my country's military. He started tormenting and defying the army of the living God. And everybody was scared of him. Nobody wanted to fight him. And so here I was, just a young teenage shepherd boy, and I walked out onto the battlefield and said, look, if nobody else wants to fight this giant, I'll fight him myself. And I did, David said, and I killed him. And overnight, he tells us, he said, I became a celebrity. People were writing songs about me. My face was on billboards. I was an overnight success by killing Goliath. And I was even invited to live in the king's palace. He says, but then something happened. People started saying things about me. People started saying that I would make a great king. And that they even started saying that I would be a better king than King Saul, David says. He says, people were saying that I would be a better king than Saul. They even wrote a song about it. David has slain 10,000. Saul has only slain 1,000. And people thought I would be a better king than King Saul. And so this angered King Saul. In fact, it made him get so mad that he literally lost his mind and became a lunatic, a raving lunatic, and started chasing me and trying to kill me. And so with the help of my friend, David tells us, he says, with the help of my friend, Jonathan, I escaped Saul's palace and I became a fugitive and I was running for my life. And I retreated and I ended up in a place called Nob. And I met up with this priest named Abimelech. And David tells us, he says, you know, I was afraid to tell the priest that I was a fugitive because I was afraid he wouldn't help me out. So I lied to him. I told him that I was cool with Saul and that Saul had sent me and that I needed some food and weapons for the military. And so he lied to this priest, Abimelech, and Abimelech gives him food and gives him weapons so that he could survive. And David tells us, he looks in the camera and he says, you know, up to that point in my life, I had always been a good example of godliness and righteousness. I had always had a firm faith in God's promises. And I know I shouldn't have lied in that moment, but I was scared, he tells us. He says, because I was scared, I lost some of my confidence in God, and I began trying to do God's will in my own way. And for a moment, in the presence of this priest, Abimelech, I stopped trusting in God's protection. And I tried to protect my own self. And I looked out for my own self. And so I lied and I manipulated. And David looks and a tear maybe starts streaming down his eyes. And he says, you know, I'm not proud of it at all. Because my lies got Abimelech and his men in trouble. Because King Saul found out that they had aided me in my escape. And he killed every one of them. And David says, you know, that's something I have to live with every day. That my lies, my sin had residual effects and people lost their lives. He says, from there though, from Nob, I left there and I went to this place called Gath. And I hope nobody would know me there. But this king, Achish, recognized me. And he said, hey, I've heard of you from this song. The song is titled, David has slain his 10,000s and Saul has slain his thousands. It's a big hit song and Achish had heard it. And Achish recognized David. And David said, he says, you know, my cover was blown when Achish recognized me. So I freaked out. And I started lying and manipulating again. I started acting like I was a lunatic. And David says, I faked insanity. And I started acting like a madman, running around, ripping my clothes off. And once again, I relied on my own wit and my own to protect myself. And I once again failed to trust God. I lived out God's will, but I did it my own way. And I had to leave Gath, once again as a fugitive, because they recognized who I was. And I had to flee to this place called Adullam. And he says, I end up in Adullam and I'm hiding out. And I enter into a cave. And I'm sitting in this cave and I'm thinking about my life and how I've hit rock bottom, so to speak, maybe even literally. It's a cave. He says, I'm thinking while I'm in this cave, he says, I'm being hunted down by the most powerful person in the world. I'm scared for my life. I realize that I've disobeyed, I've manipulated God, I've lied, and all my sin and my sins have caused other people to die. He says, I was at rock bottom, hiding out in a cave. Here I am, this celebrity, the warrior who killed Goliath. I'm the one who's anointed to be king. And here I am hiding in a cave. And David then picks up his guitar, and I'm taking liberties here. He picks up his guitar, he starts tuning it a little bit. And he says, it was in that moment that I wrote this song I'm about to play for you, Psalm 57. So there's a lot going on in this psalm. And what I just recapped for you was 1 Samuel 21 through 23. But there's a lot going on in this psalm. David is wrestling with his own moral failure, but he's also wrestling with his own suffering. The painful reality that the most powerful person in the world is hunting him down, trying to kill him. And David, he's in this cave, he's lonely, he's probably wet and cold, he's anxious about the future, he's scared for his own life, and he's ashamed of his own sin. that has caused other people to die. And he writes this song. And it says, some little intro to the song, it says, to the choir master, according to the tune of Do Not Destroy. And I love this because Do Not Destroy must have been an ancient song at the time that everyone would have known. And David says, I wrote this song to the tune of Do Not Destroy. And I like this because it's David is sampling other people's tracks long before Puffy was doing this, right? He says, all right, so the tune of Do Not Destroy, I wrote this song. And it's called A Mictum of David, When He Fled From Saul in the Cave. And the title of the song is Let Your Glory Fill the Earth. And this is what David sings. Be merciful to me, O God. Be merciful to me. For in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge till the storms of destruction pass. I cry out to God Most High, to the God who fulfills his purpose for me. He will send from heaven and save me. He will put to shame him who tramples on me. God will send out his steadfast love and his faithfulness. My soul is in the midst of lions, and I lie down amid fiery beasts, the children of man whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose tongues are sharp swords. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. My enemies, they set a net for my steps, and my soul was bowed down and brought low. My enemies, they dug a pit in my way, but they have fallen into it themselves. My heart is steadfast, though, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and I will make melody. Awake, my glory. Awake, O harp and lyre. I will awake the dawn. I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations, for your steadfast love is great to the heavens, your faithfulness to the clouds. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. Now, when I used to watch VH1 Storytellers, the thing that I loved about that show is that I could be so mesmerized by artists like Eric Clapton or Kurt Cobain or the Fugees. That was a good episode. Wyclef, Lauryn Hill. I was so mesmerized that they could tell these stories and sing these songs that could draw me into their experience. And even though I haven't lived their life, I could feel the joys and the pains that they've gone through. They invited us into their experience. And David uses the Psalms to do the same thing. He invites us into his life. But he also teaches us about God in the midst of it all. And he teaches us how to worship in the midst of overwhelming circumstances. And so today we find out from David in this song what true worship looks like in the midst of overwhelming situations. And how do we speak to God in the midst of these painful circumstances? This is what David teaches us. The first thing we see in this psalm that David teaches us about worship is that true worship understands lamenting to God. David is painfully honest about his situation. He tells God in this song straight up his fears, his failures, and he laments the pain of his life. He says, my soul is in the midst of lions, and I lie down amid fiery beasts, the children of man whose teeth are spears. He's talking about Saul. Saul had tried to spear him to death. He said, their teeth are spears and arrows. Their tongues are sharp swords. Talking about Saul trying to bring him down by slandering his reputation. David was honest about his situation and his pain to God. He said, God, I'm in a situation that I don't like, and it's killing me. And David was honest about his pain. He was honest about his situation. And to be quite honest, American Christianity has not done a good job of letting people know that it's okay to lament. See, American churches, or at least the churches I grew up in, they encourage all of us, good little Christians, to come into church on Sunday with a smile on our face. We got to be chipper all the time. Can't let anybody know that we're vulnerable. Can't let anybody know that we've got situations in our life that we don't have control of. Can't let anybody know that we're scared. Can't let anybody know that we're caught in sin. The American Christian culture has told us that it's not okay, it's not okay to be honest about our vulnerabilities, lest people think we're not, quote, good Christians. Whatever that is. And what's funny to me is that if David was a songwriter today, he would not get played on Christian radio. Because he's too raw. I have a friend who's a very successful Christian musician. And he was offered, he signed a record contract several years ago on a major Christian label for like a handful of albums. And he wrote his first album. It did really well. He was touring, playing in front of lots of people. And then it came time to write his second album. And he chose to be honest in it. And he wrote about his struggles. He wrote about the hardships of parenting and the hardships of marriage and the hardships of life and finances and struggles and everything. And when he sent these songs to these demos to his record label, they said, we can't record this. It's too dark. And he said, but it's honest. He said, and I want to write to my fans, my audience. I want them to know how to worship God in the midst of painful circumstances of life. And they told him to his face, and this is a quote from him, he said, listen, our market is suburban soccer moms who want to be uplifted on their drive to PTA meetings. And he said, well, what about the lowly and the oppressed? What about those who've buried loved ones? What about those who are in difficult marriages or those who struggle with anxiety? What about the suburban soccer moms that are facing those issues? And they said, you know, that's not our market. Write happy songs or you lose your contract. And he left his contract, and he's writing music in his own way. There was a story a few weeks ago where a major Christian bookstore stopped shelving an album by a guy named Sho Baraka. He's a rapper. And in the album, he raps honestly about his experience growing up as a young black teen in America and what that was like and his struggles and how he struggled to connect his faith with the realities of his neighborhood. And it wasn't a sanitized album. It wasn't filthy or wasn't dirty. I mean, it wasn't anything you shouldn't hear. But it was honest about his life. And it lifted up Jesus in the midst of it, but it didn't appeal to the market, so they pulled his album off the shelves. Now, listen, on the surface, from a business standpoint, that's not a big deal. Businesses have the right to carry which products they want. But it's indicative of a problem in American Christianity, that there's no longer a market in American Christianity for lament and honesty. See, our country has embraced, our Christian culture has embraced a Christianity that doesn't have a category for lament. And it's killing our worship. Because the Christian life is not always Pollyanna or Julie Andrews singing in a field of daisies, you know? There's pain, there's sorrow. And if we aren't taught today that it's okay to lament, then when suffering comes, we're not going to have the toolkit, the resources to know where to turn. And when people suffer, they're going to turn their backs on the church and turn their backs on God because they don't think that they're allowed to be raw and honest and real in the presence of God's people and in God, in front of God himself. And when we tell the world that you have to be chipper and have a fake smile painted on your face all the time when you enter into God's house, it sends a message to our non-Christian neighbors that our faith has nothing to say to their painful circumstances. But David says, oh, it absolutely has something to do with our worship. You bring your pain and your struggle to the Lord. Cast all your cares upon him, the scriptures say. So David teaches us how to worship in the midst of difficult circumstances. First is be honest, lament to God. Then he teaches us about trusting God. He says in verse 1, be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me. For in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I take refuge till the storms of destruction pass by. See, a key aspect of worship is entrusting yourself to the protection of God. Because in our lives we entrust ourselves to way too many false sanctuaries, don't we? When life gets difficult, we often get these lies in our heads that say, more money can solve this. Money is my refuge. More money could solve this problem that I have. Better sex can solve this. A promotion can solve this restlessness in my heart. Moving to the suburbs, God help us, can calm this restlessness in my heart, people, we all think. We think that the solution to our circumstances is something out there. But David understands that true worship is knowing that the only refuge that is strong enough to protect us in the midst of our painful circumstances is the presence of God himself. See, David was in a cave, and that cave offered real protection, rock walls. But David knew that God's protection was greater than the rock walls that surrounded him. And so the question is, what are you entrusting yourself to? When stress hits, when anxiety comes, when fear sets in, where do you turn? Do you turn to your own abilities, your own ingenuity to get yourself out of it, your own skill to sort of wiggle your way out of your painful circumstance? Do you turn to food or alcohol or pornography or shopping or codependency on others, desperately craving other people's approval, thinking that if they approve you, you'll be okay? Or do you entrust yourself and your circumstances to God? David says, "Be merciful to me, God." See, there's so much humility in that, to say, "God, whom have I in heaven but you? Be merciful to me." See, David knows that he cannot survive in his own strength. And this is so interesting because David was a warrior. I mean, David's like the model warrior, like the guy who took on Goliath. And so David's first impulse when he's being hunted down and Saul's trying to kill him is probably to fight back, just like most guys would be. Somebody comes at me, I'm coming after you. David's first impulse is likely to fight back, but David pauses and he says, "God, be merciful to me, avenge for me. God, you must protect me." And David says, this is the warrior who killed Goliath who says, "I'm going to cower like a little bitty tiny baby bird into the wings of God because he protects me." David, the metaphor David uses is that he's like a tiny little chick in the wings of God, because he knows that's where mercy comes from. See, he knows that he's vulnerable and that he needs protection, and his skills and his resources cannot help him survive what the situation he's facing. In 2010, after the earthquake in Haiti, I was on staff at a church at the time, and I was sort of made the point person for all trips from our church to Haiti, and we made several over the course of a few years. And so I visited Haiti pretty soon after the earthquake. And I mean, there was still rubble all over the ground. Red Cross was still trying to get there. And I remember talking to all these people, and there were so many stories of children who were orphaned because their fathers or their mothers shielded them when the buildings came crashing down. Fathers and mothers wrapping their children in their arms, and their children wrapping up into balls in their arms, so that when the concrete slabs fell on top of them, the parents were crushed, but the kids were fine. And that's such a picture of what David is saying here. He says, "David, my life is caving in," or, "God, my life is caving in all around me. I need you to cover me in the shadow of your wings. Because if you don't, I'm going to get crushed." And likewise, if we want to survive the harsh realities of life, we will need to make ourselves vulnerable, admit that we have little to offer, and throw ourselves into the mercy of God and trust that he is a pure and a safe refuge. Let him bear the pain of our life when our life comes crashing down. This is what the cross was. Jesus went on the cross and he took the crushing sting of death and sin onto himself so that we don't have to be crushed by it. That's what the cross is. See, we must learn how to lament to God, but we also must learn how to trust God, because trust is the doorway to worship. You can't worship a God you don't trust. And if we continue to trust in other things, then our worship is shallow. Our lament ought to lead us to trust in God and stand and believe that he is standing with us and for us. And that then ought to lead us to the next aspect of worship, which is hope. David says in verse 7, this is beautiful. He says, "My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and I will make melody." Here, David, it's fascinating. He's hiding out in a cave for his life, but yet in verse 7, he begins looking beyond the cave. He looks beyond his circumstances. See, God honoring worship has a tendency to help us make this turn, to move beyond lament and look beyond our circumstances and see hope in God, to trust that he's powerful and that he's just and that he's good and that he will bring about his purposes and that he will protect and provide for those whom he loves. David says, "My heart is steadfast." Other translations say, "My heart is fixed on God." And this is where worship gets good, folks. When your heart is fixed on God. When we can say that the circumstances of my life may be crazy and unpredictable, but when I approach God, I set my eyes on him like a flint. And I fix my eyes on something that's bigger and greater and beyond all of my circumstances and greater than my pain. The Apostle Paul said that the secret, the Apostle Paul said he found the secret to contentment. He said, "I know the secret to contentment in the midst of suffering." And this is coming from a guy who faced every type of torture you can imagine. He was imprisoned, he was beat, he was mocked, he was shamed, shipwrecked, you name it. And he says the way to be content is that when your life is crumbling all around you, don't focus on the situations in your immediate vicinity, but fix your eyes on what is true, what is beautiful, what is just, what is right, what is pure. And that's when he says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. He says you can endure the most painful of circumstances that this life has to offer because of Christ who strengthens you. Set your eyes on God. My heart is fixed on God, David said. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face. And the things of earth will grow strange. The dim in the light of his glory and grace. See, the purpose of our worship is to fix our eyes on Jesus so that all the chaos and all the fear seem small in the light of his glory, that they fade. A few years ago, Glenn Beck met Billy Graham. And it changed his life. Up to that point, Glenn Beck was a political commentator on Fox News, and he made millions of dollars, and these are his words, not mine. He said he made millions of dollars by invoking fear into the American people. This is his words. He says this. He had a whole television show that was dedicated to pointing out all the evils and all the wrongs in the world and all the ways in which he honestly, genuinely felt that the world was going off track. And he's recently repented and apologized and said about his former show, and he said that it caused people to panic and fear, and it didn't promote joy and hope within his viewers. But one of the things that changed Glenn Beck's heart was that he had a chance to meet Billy Graham. And Billy Graham, if you're not familiar with who he is, he's one of the greatest preachers of the 20th century. He's preached probably more people on planet Earth than anybody in history. And he's still alive today. He's 99 years old. And Billy Graham's always been politically conservative. And that's no secret, anybody who knows Billy Graham. So Glenn Beck thought that he would have a good audience to lay out his typical narrative to Billy Graham. So he gets an audience with Graham, and he starts saying, this is what's wrong with the world, this is what's wrong with the world, this is what's wrong with the world, this is what's wrong. And he's thinking Billy Graham's just going to, like, you know, love it, and it's going to be like red meat for him, and he's just going to be all excited. But Glenn Beck said that Graham didn't bite. And Glenn Beck said after this meeting with Billy Graham, he told a journalist, they said, what'd you guys talk about? He said, I went into that conversation and I was speaking to Dr. Graham about a growing darkness and evil in the world. But Billy Graham looked at me and he spoke of a greater growth of light. See, in that interview, Billy Graham was showing what true worship looks like. A life that is always confident in the light and the hope of God and always has its eyes fixed on the promises of Jesus, even when the world is going unrecognizable to the ways of Jesus. You cannot worship God unless you believe that he is good and that he is making all things new. See, hope is rooted in the confidence that God is good and that he will keep his promises. David says in verse 2, he says, I cry out to God Most High, to God who fulfills his purpose for me. He will, the confidence of this is amazing. He will send from heaven and save me. He will put to shame him who tramples on me. God will send out his steadfast love and his faithfulness. Do you see the confidence that David had? He's in a cave, and the most powerful man in the world is trying to kill him with all the resources at his disposal. And David says, God will send from heaven and save me. And David is looking ahead to the Messiah, the promise that God would come and rescue his people. And the truth is that while David looked in that cave and said, God will come, we can look and say that God has come. God answered David's prayer. He took on flesh as Jesus of Nazareth and came into the world to rescue us from sin and death. So listen to me, church. When you are struggling to worship, you look to God. But more so than David said, God will send from heaven. You can say that God has sent from heaven to save me. And then we can look with confidence to the day when Jesus will come again and make all things new. And will make every sad thing in your life come untrue. He'll wipe every tear from your eyes. Just like Eric Clapton sang, beyond the door, there's peace, I'm sure, and I know that there'll be no more tears in heaven. Because in heaven, God is going to make all things new. Everything will be just, everything will be pure, everything will be right, and everything and everyone will give honor and glory to the one who's due that honor and glory, God himself. And the last thing that David teaches us in this passage about worship is that true worship, even in the midst of difficult circumstances, always has as its end goal the proclamation of the glory of God to the world. David is in a cave, not knowing if he's going to be alive the next day. But he says in verse 9, I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations, for your steadfast love is great to the heavens and your faithfulness to the clouds. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. And David ends this song by saying, I will proclaim God's glory to the world because he's been good to me. And in this moment, David's not even in the cave anymore. His worship has literally taken him to another place in his mind. He's not even in the cave. He's in the throne room of Jesus worshiping God in this moment. He's in a place where he believes God, trusts God, hopes in God, and is looking forward to the moment where he can tell others of the goodness of God. This is why we close our services every week with the Great Commission from Matthew chapter 28, that God has told us to go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. Because that, as a church, that's our mission. Listen, the goal of worship is not to be a private experience. If your faith is private, if worship only stirs something up within you but nothing out of you, then the love of God hasn't seeped itself deep into your core. Because listen, if you came up to me and you told me that you're a diehard Mets fan, you said, hey, Will, I love the Mets. But I've never before that moment, never heard you talk about the Mets. I've never seen you wear a Mets cap or Mets gear or anything. I would think to myself, yeah, you can't be really that diehard. Why? Because a real fan talks about their team, knows the lineup, talks about them any chance they can get, wears the gear all the time. In the same way, if you've truly experienced the love and felt the joy of God, your life will be a life that can't help but speak of him to the world. See, we were created to be evangelists. I know people get weird when you use that word, evangelist, evangelism. It's in our bones. It's why Instagram exists. Because we want to evangelize our life to others. If we eat at a great restaurant, we've got to show the world. And it has to be perfect. And we stand on our chair and we get like the perfect vertical angle. And we take a picture of our plate and our food. And we use the right filter. And we send it to the world because we want that meal to look glorious to our followers. But the sad thing is by the time we've sent out the picture and made it perfect, our food's cold. It's not even any good anymore. We were created to be evangelists. When your team wins the ball game, you tell others about it. When your food is good, you Instagram it. And when we can take our laments to God and see that he's trustworthy and that he gives hope, then we have a story to tell to the world. See, true Christian worship is when the love and the hope of God sinks so deep into your soul that you want to talk about him. You want to celebrate him. You want to proclaim him. Even if you're in the middle of a cave, running for your life. When you worship and see and taste that God is good, you think to yourself, I can't wait to get out of this cave so I can tell people about how good God has been to me. And the story that gives us hope is that Jesus has come and that he's lowered himself into our world. He's experienced the fullness of the sorrows that this life has to offer, and he can relate to us. He's not a high priest who's unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but rather he became like one of us. But he remained faithful to God even in the midst of all the struggles and the trials. And on the cross, he took on the punishment for our sins, and he rescued us from death, and he has given us his spirit, and he has given us his church to know him more, to love him more, to grow in him more, so that we can then proclaim him to others. And so this is what the table of communion represents. The table of communion is a time where we come and we receive God's love so that we can go out of this place to show it to others. And so today, I want to say a quick prayer in a moment, but then we're going to have a time of worship, and you can stand and you respond any way you feel led. If you need to lament and you need to, in your seat, you just need to have it out with God. That's okay. You're allowed to do that here. If you need to just take a moment to trust in God and say, God, I know my circumstances are painful and they're hard and I don't know what tomorrow is going to look like, but I'm going to entrust myself to you. I'm going to stop trying to do this on my own. I'm going to stop trying to do this with my bank account. I'm going to stop trying to do this with whatever. Or I'm going to stop trying to numb this. But I'm going to trust that you are good in the midst of this circumstance. And maybe you need to take this time of worship to hope in God. To fix your eyes on the author and the perfecter of our faith. And fix your eyes on heaven. The place where that circumstance that you're experiencing won't be there anymore. Where death won't be a thing. And cancer won't be a thing. And depression won't be a thing. And special needs and cerebral palsy won't be a thing. Fix your eyes on that day and that'll cause hope to dwell up within you. And then when you're ready, you come and you take the bread and the cup of Jesus so that as we leave this place, you can go and you can proclaim the good news of Jesus to the world. Let's pray.